Tonight on Arena, Superman, Armand and Pavements are the movie up for reviews, and Lindsay McDougall of New Pagans on the Art of Lily Yates. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. Tonight is film review night, of course. Superman returns, the 90s slacker Rolling Stones get their musical biopic, and the complex politics of Norwegian classrooms. The actor Renate Reinsve has been a festival darling since her star turn in The Worst Person in the World, for which she won Best Actress at Cannes in 2021. She's back in cinemas now with a film called Armand, a story of how the parents, the teacher and the school cope, or don't cope, as the case may be, when one child accuses another of a terrible assault. Calling all 90s cool kids, Pavements is the title of the film about the band Pavement. Joe Keery from Stranger Things channels Steve Malkmus, the frontman of the cult indie rockers Pavement, in a very unusual biopic stroke documentary stroke kind of stage musical.
Yeah.
There's a whole bundle of things going on. That you may have heard, Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington are with me in studio. They've been to the movies for us, but we're going to start with the big one, director James Gunn's reboot of Superman. Newcomer David Corenswet in the title role, Rachel Brosnahan as Lois Lane, Nicholas Hoult as Superman's fiendishly bald arch-nemesis Lex Luthor. But do we care about any of them? There is the dog, Superdog. Does he wear a red cape? More importantly, does he have tights on and underpants over them?
Well, to disappoint you, no underpants, no tights. He does have a cape. He's not a dog. He's a CGI thing, of which there are way too many in this film. And he's a one-note joke, the dog. But the dog is only part of the problem with this film.
You haven't been out in the sun enjoying yourself today, Paul. You know?
Enjoying myself when I saw this a couple of days ago. And I did have a certain amount of goodwill towards it. The problem with every other Superman film is that the 1978 Richard Donner one it's probably the best, certainly the most likable superhero film of them all. It provided a template for all the others. As we were saying off air there, Christopher Reeve, he just was Superman. But also, they figured out very cleverly, the writers did, Mario Puzo and all these other people, that Superman is charming, but he's not very funny. So you have to counteract that. And then they had the greatest sort of super villain of them all, Gene Hackman
as
so. So every other Superman film exists in relation to that. And instead of ignoring it to some extent, they try too hard, and this one really does try hard to do too many different things.
Okay, Ruth, have you been out in the sun and enjoying yourself after watching a fine Superman movie?
Yeah, I came out into the daylight gasping and thinking, well, there's slightly over two hours of my life I'm not going to get back. I mean, I actually thought it's kind of technically competent. James Gunn, who made it, is a veteran of the superhero.
He's made some good ones.
Yeah, he's made some decent ones, and he's now kind of head of the superhero division, I think, or something.
DC, is he?
Yeah, he's superhero
director.
Tell
me that job does not exist, head of superhero
division. Yeah, I actually think it does, and he's got it.
Well,
there is too much time in the sun for you.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought, it's kind of well made. It's got a kind of rhythm to it. It's, as Paul was saying, it's heavily CGI laden, but it goes, it goes from some sort of narrative exposition to lots of conflict and fighting between the very inevitable good guys, bad guys, and the sort of sidekicks. And then there's, of course, Crypto the dog, who I discovered that I could have a robot dog. And I think my family at home would be actually quite happy to hear this, because I was quite attached to Crypto. But on the other hand, this is an utterly soulless film. Nobody has any depth to them. And because the characters can't produce
except
any depth.
Except for one person, I think, actually. I think Rachel Brosnahan, who plays
Lois. She does very, very well.
She's great.
I thought Mr. Terrific was terrific.
Who plays Mr. Terrific?
Eddie Gathegi plays Mr. Terrific. Black
and
actor.
Who's Mr. Terrific now?
So there's the Justice Gang.
He's a superhero?
Yeah.
There's
the Justice Gang, who are the kind of backups to Superman. But there's no relationship between them at all. I mean, they don't establish any kind of... They don't even explain explain why they're there. No. And one of the film's problems is it's decided to chuck you into the middle of the story rather than giving you any backstory.
And the reason it did that was because they figured, not unreasonably, everybody knows the origin story's been done very well, and then it was done again at least once. So let's do something else. So they try and plunge us into the middle of a story. But the story is trying too hard. There is this thing about a tear in the universe, which I really didn't need at 11:30 on a Tuesday morning. It's just it. And also the CGI is thrown at things, as are the characters. On the way into the cinema at the start of the film, there was all these various actors doing different characters. It's too much.
In the cinema?
Yeah, but they're throwing everything at it. It's too much. It's not simple enough.
It's on every bus side. You know, this is the big summer movie. They've poured millions, hundreds of millions.
And it might do
this.
Okay. Yeah.
I think it will do, but it's got this incredibly simplistic message about, you know, doing good in a complex world. And I think, you know, audiences may fall for that.
A lot of people could listen to that message, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, it does, you know, extract all the evil and put it into one corner and all the good into the other corner.
Yeah,
and
you can
make your decisions, but, I mean, it's not even fun being on the side of the bad guy because he's fairly indifferent.
Who is playing Nicholas Holt. Yeah, okay. Right, let's have a listen to David Corenswet as Superman. The wonderful Crypto the Dog. I'm so disappointed that he's a CGI dog. I wanted it to be a real dog.
I feel like I've
depressed
you, Sean.
Yeah, well, you have done it. I thought for a moment...
Sean's not rushing to this one.
Well, I could hear for a moment there was a bit of hope there. I could hear kind of a nostalgia in both your voices. And then, we came to the CGI and the
two-footed tackle.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Right, let's have a listen to the clip. Crypto the Dog, played by the CGI Crypto, and David Corenswet as Superman.
Sir?
What is this? Crypto!
What the hey, dude? I thought
you destroyed the whole Superman robots. I thought I told you to keep an eye on him.
We feed the canine, but he is unruly. And he realizes we are not flesh and blood and couldn't, in our heart of hearts, care less whether he lives or dies.
Stop, Crypto, leave it. Ow, ow, stop. Ow, stop. Crypto, ow, ow, stop it, stop. Sit, stay.
Yeah, there's Crypto, and it also always has one ear sort of up.
But that's because so it can hear things, yeah?
But yeah, that's right.
But it's not an actual ear, it's a CGI ear.
No, one CGI ear is up and one is down, which just gives it that cute doggy look.
You see, you're kind of buying into the dog
dead
as we go along, Ruth. You've both mentioned Rachel Brosnahan as Lois Lane, rather. What about Nicholas Holt as the baddie and, of course, Corenswet himself as Superman?
Well, it's impossible to say whether Corenswet he sort of looks like he would be good, but it's impossible to say because we never really get to know him. I don't know how good he is at acting, but maybe he is. Nicholas Holt is what they have repurposed Lex as a kind of tech bro, basically, which, you know, is supposed to allow us all to hate him, and of course does. But he doesn't enjoy being wicked, and I think Lex Luthor is just a pain if he's not enjoying himself. He's never funny. Nobody's ever funny, not even that dog. And the only, for whatever stars I give this, the only reason I'm going to be giving them are because of Rachel Brosnahan, because she is great. She, by dint of acting, she manages to pull a character out of things.
You see, the whole acting thing.
The actors, you can't
go
by them.
Has to be acknowledged.
And what are you acting against? You're acting against a green screen.
Yeah, no, she was great. There's lots of wasted actors as well in this film.
Hugely wasted. Yeah.
All right. I think I'm getting the hint from both of you. Yeah. I'm almost afraid to ask for stars, but shall I? I don't know. In your case, Paul, these are all for Rachel Brosnahan.
I give it two, and 1¾ is for Rachel Brosnahan. Yeah. And some of the effects were okay.
Okay. Some of the effects were okay. I don't think that's going in the poster. Kind of work. It's kind of well made and kind of got a kind of rhythm, is what you said earlier on.
Yeah, and I'm kind of giving it 2.5 because I kind of did like Crypto a little bit more than Paul did. So half for Crypto, 2 for a total waste of 2 hours and something in the region of $200 million.
But there'll be more of this because this is the beginning of something. There are sequels
planned. Yeah, it's a reinvention.
Supergirl.
Okay.
Superdog.
All right. But family fun over the summer if it gets rainy? Well, there's a big long silence.
I think if they haven't seen the original, because we've seen the original, so you know. But if you're
that's the point. If you haven't seen
the younger generation won't have seen
somehow
the original.
It might be off.
Yeah. Okay. Or you could just get Christopher Reeve out.
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to say on video. Yeah. You could possibly watch it on some platform or other where it's streaming.
Anymore,
it might be streaming somewhere. I'm sure it is. Okay, not a high recommendation from either of you there. Let's move on then to Armand, story of a school's investigation into terrible allegations made against a six-year-old child by one of his classmates. Renato Reinsve, I was talking about here, stars as the character Elizabeth. She's the mother of the young accused child. Fairly difficult stuff, this particular area, you know. These kind of differences between parents and children can be very difficult to handle.
Yeah, I mean, this is a film that starts in a very troubling manner because, and actually, you know, Reinsev is fantastic. Mm. She really
is. Yeah, she's great.
She's great.
Yeah.
And she's,
the way she uses her body and
her face. Mm. And in fact, I mean, so in fact is Ellen Dorrit Peterson.
This will be the Isle acting again, will it?
Yeah, we're big on our actors and poor
on us today.
Poor on our narrative because, so it starts off, you know, with this awful accusation that her son, she's a widow, she's a famous actor. Her son, Armand, has been accused of assaulting, possibly sexually assaulting, his good friend, John, at school.
Six.
And they're only six.
Yeah.
So her line is, how could this possibly be? But by the time she's walked into the room where the class teacher and various people from the school have come together with John's parents, it seems like the decision has been made. The child is guilty.
Yeah, and we're not really looking at the children here, is my understanding, Paul. We're looking at the dynamic between the parents. There is a relationship between the parents that I think we should keep because that's kind of revealed later on. We should keep that separate.
I suppose it is.
Yeah.
Lucky you said that, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, we should say, first of all, that the director, Halfdan Ullmann, happens to have very famous grandparents, Liv Ullmann and Ingmar Bergman, so no pressure on him.
And this is his first feature, but you know, he's a person in his own right and a filmmaker.
He's a person.
Yep.
He's a person.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, the as Ruth was suggesting, I think the setup was interesting and the ideas are interesting.
It reminded me a bit of that film, The Slap, and though, you know, those kind of dynamic.
The teacher's lounge, particularly reviewed the teacher's lounge.
Yeah, and various other films, which was a good film.
Very, very good.
It's better than this, actually.
So
the setup's good and she's great. And there's a rhythm in the film, which is very good at the start. And in fact, she helps establish it. She has these kind of big boots that giant.
Is this Reinsve?
As she walks into the school. And she's a funny mixture because she's such a good actor. She can do this. She's a funny mixture of confident and not confident. And as you suggest, there's a lot of loaded when the parents meet. Well, her and the parents of the other child meet. There's a lot of loaded kind of subtext. And the teachers, it's quite funny because... you know, this being Scandinavian, Norway, like there's a lot of correctness going on, and they're trying to negotiate it all and failing sometimes. And one of them keeps getting a nosebleed, which gets in the way. And there's one really sweet teacher who's their actual teacher, who I think suspects that all is not as it seems and is trying to battle against the headmaster who has a favourite among the suspects, if you like.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not really about the children at all. It's about parenting in a funny way. And it's good for a long time. But I said that she uses her body a bit like a dancer, but then she does break into dance at one point, and there's another surreal bit, and those actually undercut the effectiveness and the tension, the drama.
Because it does sound like it has that kind of psychological tension involved in it, and looking at how the school, the dynamics of a school staff, and how I think there's a very young teacher in this. Is she going to be supported, or is she just going to be, you know, made into the scapegoat?
Yes, Suna is very young, and she's looking for direction from her, from the more experienced staff members, and she's saying, What are the protocols here? And they're saying, well, I'll just kind of take
it. They sort of push her through the door.
They've all learned how to not say anything.
And then, of course, as soon as she can't cope, which she can't, even though she's really clearly doing her best, then they just step in and totally undermine her authority.
Yeah.
And then they all sit in the room and they still get nowhere because this is an unknowable mystery. How do you know what happened between these 2 6-year-olds?
I have to say, it does sound like a fascinating setup. And even as you're describing it, I can hear certain kind of caveats along the way. But that is it an enjoyable watch?
Well, you know, here's the thing. Okay, I don't think you can put the elephant in the room back in the box to mix a load of cliches, because it is Bergman's grandson.
Yeah,
and he is clearly influenced by particularly Persona. You know, the film about, you know, with an actor, two women, and the two women are the protagonists. Antagonists are often shot with their faces kind of blending in slightly to each other in a very Persona-like manner. But where I think he has not learned from his grandfather is that Bergman knew a film had to tell a story. And so you could be as arty as you like and have as many moody shots as you like, but you had to bring your audience through that journey.
They have to relate to the story. Yeah,
they have to emotionally relate to it. And this film is far too long. And it drifts, and as you said, there's this surreal dance sequence, there's another surreal dance sequence, there are hints of relationships that never really get teased out, and there are repeated shots of this kind of school's empty corridors, which makes it look like a kind of sanatorium.
I think in doing those things, he's trying to resist the fact that the film starts to feel like a play, but I think that's okay. I think it would have been better if he'd stayed almost in the one room and had the nerve to do that.
Yeah. And just...
And let the actors save it, sure.
If somebody had, you know, the bravery... I mean, this has been a very loaded film. It won a big prize at Cannes.
Yeah, Cameron Dore, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But if somebody had the bravery to snip sort of between 20 to 30 minutes off it, that would have made it a tight,
focused film. To be fair to Halfdan Ullmann Tundel, whose name trips off the tongue.
It sure is.
It's his debut feature, so, you know.
Oh, lots of promise in it, and he handles the actress very well. I mean, she is just terrific in it. And so is Sarah, the other woman, as well. She's really very good.
Okay, this sounds more promising. Stars from you on this
three
one.
Three stars.
Oh, yeah, three. Paul and Ruth?
It's really not the same as Superman, but it's still got 2.5. I was disappointed and bored by the end of it.
It just needed to have ended much earlier.
Yeah,
less is always more. Let us move on to Pavements, a rock documentary of sorts about the 90s cult rock band Pavement. It really is an unusual film, and even trying to set out what the... There are almost four different strands to the film, Paul.
There are, and therein lies the problem for me, though not for Ruth, I think.
But, I loved it.
I think that one has to say that it's a, if you can call it a documentary, it's a film that suits its subject, because Pavement were very tricky, as all the 90s hipsters know.
Were you a fan?
I was, yeah, but I was also slightly infuriated by them. There were other bands I liked more because they were less up themselves.
Yeah, so you were clever enough to know that Pavement were too clever for their own good.
Oh, I thought they were too clever, though. They would probably say I wasn't clever enough to understand,
of course.
But no, they had this adoring kind of a very large cult following by the end of the 90s.
Yeah,
and they bickered their way out of existence, and then they came back. This film is partly inspired by the fact that in 2022, after COVID, they started sort of international tour. At the same time, this sort of moving, it's kind of like a shambolic multimedia assault, which typical of them. This kind of mobile museum thing started cranking its way around America, and then there was this strange kind of
jukebox musical,
which had a brief run in New York. So all those things are happening, but not just that, Sean. Also, this kind of mockumentary in which actors play, and that's actually the most amusing, fun bit of it for me.
Ruth is nodding and smiling furiously here.
Yeah, I loved it because I thought it did justice to the band. And
so you were a fan, were you?
No, I wasn't a fan at all. I barely knew them. I mean, I was kind of, you know, name was sort of somewhere at my wider horizon. So this for me was actually an introduction to them, really. And I loved it because a lot of it...
Did you like the music, some of the music?
Yeah, I did. I really liked the music. Yeah. And a lot of it is conducted with actual just straightforward documentary interviews with Malkmus, the band leader.
He's tricky.
He is cynical. Mm. He's self-deprecating. Mm. He is, you know, too cool for school. And he's also got this, you know, ambiguous relationship with the band's own history, which is he knew they failed in the 90s, but he wanted them to fail because otherwise they'd have been a commercial success. And we don't want that kind of thing.
I'm not sure I was convinced by his arguments. And actually, he kept getting in their way because they should have been and they weren't. Yeah. But that's what he says anyway.
Yeah, that's the way he sees things.
And so we have that documentary aspect. We have this mobile museum thing. We have also this the stage musical, which is a jukebox musical of
yes.
But then the mockumentaries, which is where there seems to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, the mockumentary is called Range Life. And even all of these things, these happenings, have names. So the musical is Slanted Enchanted, a pavement musical, and then Range Life is in the mould of Bohemian Rhapsody, but really very clearly
and
not.
And does it keep skipping from one thing to the other?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually split screen.
All right.
So
it's trying to make fun of a lot of things at the same time.
To mock
a lot of things at the same time.
Yeah, but having watched Superman, this is what I needed for my summer movie watching. But sometimes it's even like, sometimes it's not just split screen two, with two things happening. It could be even split screen four, with all four things happening.
Oh, you have to be very clever to watch
Or else you need to just go along kind of in the mood. But the biopic is actually really...
Your man
Joe Keery from Stranger Things is so funny.
We have a clip with him, Joe Keery as Steve Malkmus, and his manager, played by Tim Heidecker, is trying to get him to do an appearance on Saturday Night Live. But of course he couldn't be doing anything like that. That'd be selling out. You'll hear Jason Schwartzman in here too as Chris Lombardi. Be warned, they like a bit of language, the boys, as they're chatting to each other.
Hey man, listen.
Forget Rolling Stone. Fuck Rolling Stone. We got something better.
All right.
We just got a call from Lorne Michaels.
And they want you, Pavement, to be the musical guest on an upcoming episode of SNL.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
So listen.
The other thing is, the host apparently is Quentin Tarantino. And if you buy into this kind of shit, that's the episode that all the so-called cool kids are going to be taping, so.
Right.
We feel like this is a no-brainer. Here you say, great. Yes.
When do we show up?
Yeah, when do we be there? I don't want to do that.
Well, I could go back and I could see if you can, you know, fuck it up like The Replacements.
Well, not like The Replacements, but
Elvis Costello, I don't know. Wear a fucking dress.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
Oh dear.
See, our poor manager, not a hope. Joe Keery. By the way, my understanding is Steve Martin. He's watching cats on YouTube or whatever.
As he's holding, he has kind of
become him. But I wish the whole film had been that.
Just
I didn't need all the rest of it. Yeah. I just needed them because it was funny.
Oh, it was very funny. I mean, there's a great sequence where he needs to get a close up of Malkmus's throat. Because he wants, if he thinks by studying his throat formation, he may get his Southern Californian accent a little better.
I think we may have a hung jury on this one. What are you saying, stars-wise, Ruth?
I gave it 4 out of 5. I loved it.
4 out of 5. She loved it. Paul?
So, well, I tell you, just when I used to listen to Pavement albums, I really wanted to like them, but I'd like one song and then the next one would really annoy the crap out of me. And I felt like that about this film. Two and a half stars, but I wish it had been the mockumentary, the whole thing.
It would have got a lot more from you. All right. Thanks to Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington. Superman, not surprisingly, is on general release tomorrow, I think. I don't think either of you will be going back to cinema. Armand and Pavements will be in selected cinemas also from tomorrow. Should have asked you about the music. Who plays it in? Is it Pavements, old Pavements recordings, or do you know?
Concert footage from 2022 and some old stuff as well. Yeah.
Do we hear a song called Cut Your Hair?
Yes.
Yes.
Do you like it, Ruth?
Yes, I do. I mean, I loved, and there's, you know, Crooked Rain, which is, you know, iconic. I did enjoy the music.
Do you like Cut Your Hair?
Yes, I do. I have to say, I do like something. Yeah.
Okay. The two jury members are now in total accord with each other. Before they change their minds,
let us listen to Cut Your Hair from the
Ah, yeah, they are funny songs, aren't they? That is Cut Your Hair from the band Pavement, which are the subject of the film Pavements that Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington were talking to us about, alongside Superman and Armand. In the pantheon of Irish cultural icons, the Yeats name looms large. But have the contributions of sisters Susan and Elizabeth, or Lily and Lolly as they were affectionately known, have they remained overshadowed by their famous brothers W.B. and Jack B.? Dr. Lindsay McDougall, Belfast-based, art historian, lecturer and the front woman of the band New Pagans, has devoted the past several years to researching the life and work of Lily Yeats, in particular, whose hand-embroidered ecclesiastical banners for Loughrea Cathedral form the centrepiece of McDougall's PhD, and her upcoming talk at the Yeats Sisters Symposium in Dublin. Delighted that Lindsay joins us on the programme this evening. I'm guessing your answer to that question, for starters, Lindsay, is absolutely they have been. This, the work of the sisters have been overshadowed by the work of the works and the reputations of the brothers. But talk to me a little bit about those, and I can say the word ecclesiastical banners at Loughrea Cathedral, which I think pretty much are the centre of the importance of Lily Yeats for you.
Yes, well, it's certainly the centre of my own personal research. Of course, there's lots of research going on around the sisters now, which is wonderful to read about and hear about. But yes, my focus has been on Lily Yeats because of her. She was the head of the embroidery department at Dunemer, and I'm an embroiderer as well. So I just was fascinated by her, and I came across her. It was about 10 years ago, actually, and I was just reading a book about Mae Morris, and then I came across Lily's name, and I thought, is she related to the brothers? Mm. And then I discovered that she was, and it was sort of this moment of, whoa, why do I not know about this person already? So yes, my answer is we should all know about the Yeats sisters.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Dunemer Guild there, which is a vital part of understanding Lily Yeats and her, not just what she did as an artist, but in fact, as a kind of a person who was involved in the cultural life of this country at a very particular time in history and very important in pushing that cultural life forward.
100%. Yeah, Dunemer was really an arts and crafts sort of example and part of the Celtic revival as well. And along with Evelyn Gleeson, and so it was Lily, Evelyn Gleeson and Elizabeth Yeats who founded it in, I think it was 1902. So at that point in time, it was really interesting. It wasn't just, as you said, about just being creative, but it was about the community around where they had sort of founded this guild, which was in Dundrum area. So evidence does suggest that it actually helped that area grow economically. And so that's really interesting part of the research that's going on, I think, at the minute. And certainly I'm not the only person sort of looking into that, but it's a really interesting part of the guild. Yeah.
And I suppose the choice of embroidery here, it links into Emer, I should say, who Cullen was married to, rather than the other way around, shouldn't I really?
yes, well done.
But I'm wondering, what was the attitude to embroidery at this particular point in time? I mean, we're talking about, you know, the cultural, our own kind of cultural revolution at the beginning of the 20th century, which led ultimately to the political revolution that happened in the second decade of that century. Mm-hmm. How was embroidery regarded?
Well, I think it was regarded, and to a certain extent, I think it still is regarded to a certain extent as a sort of feminine activity, something that women did. So I think in that way, it was quite clever of Lily to sort of take that on as a tool of resilience or tool of empowerment, you know, where these women were able to sort of carve out these spaces for themselves. And certainly through embroidery, that's certainly my interest in, you know, how embroidery was used by Irish women at this point in time to really sort of even find some financial independence to help other women. So they were also employing women in the local community who were perhaps not as well off as them. So it's really interesting that women found, I think, because it was a space that men weren't dominating, they were able to actually thrive.
But absolutely. And I think there are a couple of actions on the part of Lily Yeats and what she did with her, but not just the subject matter, not just the skill and the artistry that she showed in what she made, but how she actually made sure it was clear. Let me tell you, this isn't just a piece of embroidery. this is my piece of embroidery. So how did she go about making sure that that was evident to everybody?
Yes, well, now, in the Loch Gregg Cathedral banners, she didn't do this.
Yes.
But when she replicates some of the banners, so she does this in a couple of occasions, she actually signs her name at the bottom, which is really unusual activity in the embroidery world. Even now, I mean, as I said, I'm an embroiderer, but I do sign, and I sign my work now because of Lily Yates, because we would do that in painting and any other art form, really. We would have some form of, you know, authorship over it and put her name. So she did that, which was really unusual, I would argue, at that time to do that. So she would sign her name in the bottom in thread, and which is what I do as well. So it's a nod to Lily every time I do that, actually.
Absolutely.
In my own work.
and explain to me a little bit more, if you would, Lindsay, about the Loch Gregg Cathedral banners themselves. What's the subject matter here?
So they were looking, they were asked, so obviously it's an ecclesiastic commission, as you said. There was 29 banners made, and they were asked to do banners of lots of different saints. So if you go onto the Loch Gregg website, you can actually see all of the banners there. So there's 27 banners, and then there's two processional banners as well. So it's really all about the Irish saints. But I think as well, what I argue is that Lily actually sort of took it one step further and didn't just copy all of the kind of stuff that she'd seen before in the way saints were depicted, but she actually sort of came up with a new way, a more modern way of looking at the saints, where arguably they look more Irish, slightly more Irish, or a little bit more accessible to the ordinary sort of churchgoer. So she kind of she does change, and certainly the Irish press at that time, so in 1903, there's quite a lot of sort of written around it, and it's all very positive and all sort of points to the fact that although it might not look modern to us,
they were saying
this is a really modern depiction of Irish, of saints, not just Irish saints, but lots of different types of saints. So it was really interesting.
I wonder too, if we looked closely, you know, the way stonemasons in cathedrals and in churches would often, there'd be some part of the decoration within the church itself that would be of the stonemason or of one of the carvers, of one of the men working on the thing. I wonder if we look closely, might we find faces of some of the women in the faces of these saints? That would be there's your second PhD sorted out for you now. It isn't just that Lily Yates and her work has inspired you as a student and as in your researches. It has also inspired you and your band, New Pagans.
I know. God love them. they've been dragged into it. When I was talking about that 10 years ago, when I discovered Lily Yates' name in this book about memoirs, I actually just went on this sort of rampage of just really researching the Yates sisters. And at that time, you know, there was very little, there was a couple of books that I could get hold of and read, Lewis Gifford's book and then Joan Hardwick's book. And so I read those, but after that I was like, needed to do my own research. But the band, certainly I came to the band with, the song, and they were like, okay,
we're going to do this
about an embroidery. And then they all, to be honest, everybody really enjoyed learning about the sisters, and everyone that I talked to that didn't know about them in Ireland certainly were quite shocked that they hadn't been more famous, I guess.
Let's have a listen to a little bit of the band New Pagans, obviously featuring yourself and your husband, I think, is part of the band as well, isn't he?
That's true.
And the song is simply called Lily Yates.
The uneasy.
Just a little bit there of the song Lily Yates from the band New Pagans, and Lindsay McDougall of the band New Pagans, and the scholar who has been looking into the work of Lily Yates is with me on the programme this evening ahead of a symposium about the work of both Lily and Lolly, or Susan and Elizabeth Yates, which is taking place in Dublin this weekend. But you really get the sense, just from listening to even those first couple of verses there, Lindsay, you're talking about this whole thing that Lily Yates certainly put out this message that you can be anything and you can do whatever you want to do, and a daughter needs to know that.
Yeah, and I think for me it was, you know, once I, at the time I had no children. I do have a daughter and a son now, so I was being quite I didn't know I was going to have a daughter at that time.
You were looking to the future.
Anyway, yeah, I was looking to the, I couldn't think of the word. Yes, I was looking to the future. And but I was thinking about that. You know, when I found out about Lily and Elizabeth and Evelyn, I really wanted to know more. And I kind of was raging that I didn't know about it. So I suppose that's where that came from. Mm. I wanted my daughter or my kids to know, you know, about the resilience, how brave they were, you know, at a time when, let's be honest, women in Ireland were very limited in what they could do professionally. They kind of carved out this space for themselves to help themselves, but also other women, which I find really inspirational. So, yes.
And in terms of the symposium coming up at the weekend, is it specifically Lily's work that you are concentrating on, or do you, because the sisters together, Lily and
yes.
Elizabeth, were very powerful as a pair?
100%. So it's the Yates Sisters Symposium. Mm. So it's in the Dundrum on Saturday. But there's lots of different speakers. There's Dr. Antonia Hart, and then Sinead McCool, and there's lots of different speakers, and everyone's talking about different things. But I think the first session, or the first section of the symposium, is based really on Elizabeth's work, actually. And then the second one is about the creative development of the sisters within the place, within Dundrum. So that's kind of the emphasis there. So there's, I think every year they take a different sort of take on it, and they focus on different areas. So those are the two for this year. But yeah, this is the third symposium, so it happens annually.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously establishing itself very well in the process of doing that. Thanks for speaking with us this evening, Lindsay. Lovely to talk
with
you.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. That's Lindsay McDougall. And Lindsay will give her talk about the Dooney McGill and Lily Yates in particular at the Loughrea Cathedral Banners, and Lily Yates' creative leadership in the Irish Arts and Crafts Revival as part of the Yates Sisters Symposium at Taney Parish Centre in Dundrum in Dublin this Saturday, July the 12th. And you can find out full information on theyatesisters.com. Martin McDonagh's play The Pillowman first premiered at the Royal National Theatre in London in 2003. It won an Olivier Award. It transferred to Broadway for 6 months and brought McDonagh's particular mix of humour and savagery to an international audience in so doing. Last night, a new production opened at the Gate Theatre with Fraffy, Aidan McCardle, Ryan Dillon and Julianne Moore-Cook in the main roles. Helen Meaney would along to review for us. She's with me in studio this evening. We spoke to Fraffy about this, I think, just as they were heading into their technical rehearsals, in fact, and he was quite excited about it. It's set in a totalitarian state, but it's an unnamed state, Helen. It's very non-specific in terms of both time and location in that respect, is it?
It's almost abstract in that way. So we don't know where we are, we don't know when, so it's not necessarily the present. It could be somewhere in Central Europe. It could be any time really between now and maybe 50 years ago, 60 years ago. And in a way, that doesn't matter too much. Mm. It's the sense of somebody being taken in for questioning. We see him blindfold, first of all, the character Couturier. He hasn't even been charged. So it's very much like Kafka's the trial in that way, in that he doesn't know why he's even there.
He doesn't know why he's there. And he's a writer. This Couturier is a writer.
He is a writer.
Of stories, children's inverted commas stories.
He's written 400 short stories, only one of which has been published. And they're all involve in one way or another extreme cruelty to children. Mm. And that you know, it eventually transpires is why he's been brought into custody. It's because there's been a number of murders in the town that appear to be using exactly the same methods.
Yeah, kind of a copycat of what he has written in the stories.
Yes.
So he's been interrogated along these lines. I mean, it's very different when you hear about a totalitarian state and that it's nameless and timeless in some ways. Did you find yourself making any parallels to contemporary situations, or is this in fact more about the nature of the writer in this situation, or the person who has been, in inverted commas, potentially censored?
It's both, really. I mean, you cannot just ignore the fact that we're in this coercive regime, and yes, it does. It does have resonance with today, but it's not specific.
Yeah.
But in another way, it doesn't need to be, because we're in dangerous times, you know. But it's not. It's really about what is the responsibility of the artist, of the writer, to create work that is free of inference or the assumption that it's a political statement or a political allegory, but also what is the responsibility when the writer, like this one, Couturier, writes extremely violent, cruel stories, and what then is the impact of that? Yeah. So there's a lot going on here in terms of questioning, and in some ways it refers to McDonagh's own work, which, as we know, his stage work in particular has been. You know, found to be too violent. And so there is a lot of commentary about writing itself.
So in some ways it comes across in the play itself comes across as a defense for the artist's right to say, write, paint, create whatever he or she thinks
fit.
Yeah,
I mean, those arguments are given to Couturier, and almost saying that these stories are autonomous, they exist outside
of real time,
yes,
and real places.
Yes, and he makes that argument over and over, even when he's been tortured. And his desire is for the stories, even if he is executed, so they're threatening him with execution, he wants his stories to survive. He doesn't want them to be burned by his interrogators. And that's really his main concern.
So we have two interrogators, and so far we've only spoken about the one writer, the one other person, Couturier. But there is an added layer of, I suppose, confusion, or an added layer of tension and drama added by the other person who's been held by these two interrogators.
Yes, and that other person is his brother, and he's been held in another room. Now, the two brothers are close and they live together, and it all becomes really quite entangled in a short story that Couturier has written called the Writer and His Brother. Without giving away too much, the brother is intellectually impaired in some way and is quite dependent on Couturier, but the dynamic between the brothers shifts in a very significant way.
Yeah, the brothers is Michael, isn't he, played by Ryan Dillon?
Ryan Dillon, very well, very subtle, understated. Yes, he seems quite meek and timid, but he turns out really not to be. It's not a simple characterization.
Yeah.
They're very good together, by the way. So they have a whole central scene together, all, you know, teasing out the endings of Couturier's stories and how they may have influenced
the brother.
Or another reader of the stories. Yes,
yeah,
so it's all about what control does Couturier have over the effect his fiction might have.
And Fraffy was at great pains to point out to me that it was purely accidental that both he and Ryan Dillon were from the north. Whereas the two interrogators, Aidan McArdle as Topolsky and Julianne Moore Cook as Ariel, are Dublin based and certainly have a southern feel to their delivery and presence. Does that play into it in any way, or is that just me picking up on an accident of location?
I mean, you can't ignore the accents, but so it feeds into something, I suppose, that here in Ireland we're familiar with. It's a sort of a background thrum of the Troubles, but it's actually not the main point.
It's not that specific,
but yet it's you know, it provides a certain amount of, I think it does provide tension. There is a lot of tension in this. There's a lot of menace in that kind of Pinter-esque kind of way. There's a sense of threat. We hear shrieks and noises from the room next door. We then realise that it's torture, or it may or may not be.
Yeah, and we hear these sounds off stage.
That are recorded.
I mean, which is not always the case in a McDonagh play. You see and hear the violence on stage.
We also see violence on stage.
And how does that work? How is that balanced with the story that's been told?
It's probably not as graphic as other McDonagh plays. And also in the staging, in the retelling, Couturier relates some of the stories that he's written, and two of them in particular, and they are very violent. Oops, dropped my glasses. And we see them enacted in a separate space high above the stage.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, because there is a feel of the stories that they are, again, I'm making large air inverted commas, that they are children's stories, but they're stories that involve, as you have said, a lot of cruelty to children. So is there a tension being played between the idea of the fairy story and the absolutely gruesome nature of the story that's been told? How is that presented on stage?
Yes, so in this cut-out kind of neon lit box high up on the stage, we see almost like a puppetry version, or a kind of
a mimetic version of it.
Yes,
is it? Yeah.
Exactly. While Couturier tells the story, and one of them is this one of the writer and his brother, which is a story of extreme cruelty to young children, and all throughout we were kind of asked to believe that this may or may not be Couturier and Michael's own story. Now Couturier insists that nothing he writes is autobiographical, and you know, but then it plays out in a way that suggests that it could be their own story, and in other words, that the impact of extreme cruelty on children has turned them, possibly, and some of the other characters, into very sadistic characters themselves. So it's looking at the impact of cruelty to children, and that's exactly what Couturier's own stories are doing, in ways that are some ways like twists on a grim fairy tale, where a child is offers something as a gift and then his toes are cut off, or a little girl swallows apples which are covering razor blades. There's a horrific story of a girl, a little child, who thinks she's Jesus, and her parents basically crucify her and bury her alive. Cut to the chase there.
Clearly, this is, while it treats children's stories, it is a play that is for an adult
but
audience.
But you see, just to clarify, Couturier never says that they're for children.
Yeah, they're just stories about children.
Yeah, they wouldn't be children's material.
Well, mind you, actually, some of Grimm's fairy tales you wouldn't be.
Yeah, certainly not young children. Yeah. But also, that's the thing to say about this production, while we're on that. It is not for children.
Yeah,
it's, when the violence is off stage, there is on stage torture. There's a reference to suicide, child abuse, you name it.
Yeah, so be absolutely clear, it's for an adult audience.
Yeah,
The cast is completed then. We have the two brothers, we have the two interrogators, and we have father and mother, played by Dedeca O'Dea and Jade O'Connor. How important are how do those parental roles fit into the story that's been told?
Well, they're in the tableau of the retelling of the little girl who was Jesus story, and the retelling of the writer's childhood story. So they really are not. They're in very, very vivid and extremely elaborate costumes, which give us that indication that we're in the fairy tale world, or we're in the memory world. But they are not. They're really quite small roles, because they're miming essentially.
Yeah, and they're referred to as father and mother, and we can infer whose father and mother they may or may not be. I can't imagine the McDonagh spells that out in a straightforward way.
So nothing is stable. That's the interesting thing.
Yeah,
and so, you know, and then we get a lot of his characteristic kind of caustic humour and certain amount of repetition. But the cumulative effect is to create this reflexive hall of mirrors, that even the basic things we know about what's going on may not be true.
Standout performances?
Yeah, I actually thought all four of the lead the major, characters were
Fraffy, Ryan Dillon, Topolsky,
really
Julianne Moore Cook, the brothers and the interrogators.
Aidan McArdle, I thought, was very, very good as Topolsky, the detective. Mm. He was just very contained. And again, we hear more about the two interrogators later on and their miserable childhood. So yeah. It's like nothing is as it seems. It's quite morally murky.
So Lindsay Turner seems as if she has brought out that great ambivalence that is often within a McDonagh play, of this wild type of humour, but this serious violence not too far away.
Yes, there is. I think it's a restrained, quite austere production, but she gets those great performances. I mean, there will be some people who just find it too much, just too caustic, too cruel. But I think the point is a sort of a more profound one.
So it sounds, if you like McDonagh's work, this is a good work to go and see, because it's him kind of stating in some ways this is what the writer does and should be allowed to do.
Yes, and if you have a tolerance for McDonagh and the menace and the violence, well then I think this is a good production of it.
Right.
Yes,
good production of The Pillow Man is what Helen Meaney is saying there for us. It runs at the Gate Theatre through until September the 7th, and you can get full details at gatetheatre.ie. Just to remind you, tomorrow night, Too Much, we'll be reviewing on television, Too Much, the new Lena Dunham on Netflix mixtape, an Irish-Australian miniseries about a couple who fall in love as teenagers. They're separated, they meet again years later, and it's all about mixtapes and the romance of that. And Dexter Resurrection. This is a serial killer who wakes up from a coma. I don't need to think I need to say any more about that. There you go. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. Liam Mullen was on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. So I'll be back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.